From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Horton Foote wrote the screenplays for To Kill a Mockingbird, Tender Mercies, and A Trip to Bountiful, all set in small southern towns. On this edition of Fresh Air, Horton Foote tells us about the influence of his own hometown, Wharton, Texas. This summer, public television is showcasing music films about jazz tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins, soul star and preacher Al Green, and salsa musician and actor Ruben Blades. Coming up, a preview with the filmmaker Robert Muggy. Critic at Large Laurie Stone has a review of the Museum of Modern Art's exhibit of photographs by the late Gary Winogrand. And singer Susanna McCorkle is back in our weekly performance spot with a couple of Cole Porter songs. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote won his first Academy Award in 1962 for his adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. 21 years later, he won his second Academy Award for his screenplay Tender Mercies. Actress Geraldine Page received an Oscar for her performance in Foote's movie A Trip to Bountiful. Public television's American Playhouse has presented several of the plays in Foote's 9-part Orphan's Home cycle. Grove Press has just published a second volume of plays in the cycle. Horton Foote considers memory an unreliable thing, but much of his writing is based on his memories of growing up in the small town of Wharton, Texas. Fictionalized versions of that town have been the settings for most of his stories. A Trip to Bountiful was about an elderly woman who was forced to leave such a town when her son got a job in Houston. Her fantasy was to leave Houston and return to her old home in Bountiful, but when she summoned up the strength to leave her son, she found that Bountiful virtually no longer existed. The houses were boarded up. The day before she arrived, the last resident of Bountiful had died. All she could do was take one last look at her home.
That's all I want, just to see it, just to stand on the porch of my own house again.
Lady, I don't have anything
to... I thought last night that I had to stay. I thought I would just die if I couldn't stay. But now, I'll settle for less. An hour. Half an hour.
Horton Foote, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And to start our interview, I'd actually like to ask you to read something from your new book of plays, something from the introduction that you wrote about change in your life.
All right, be happy to. Change was an early acquaintance in my life. My grandfather, who seemed impervious to all mortal ends, died when I was 9. And the reverberations and changes from that death continued for many years. It was soon after that I was to see a quiet, serene street in front of my grandparents' house begin its slow but steady descent into a metaphor for all the ugly, trashy highways that scar a great deal of small-town America. And these plays, I feel, are about change, unexpected, unasked for, unwanted, but to be faced and dealt with, or else we sink into despair or a hopeless longing for a life that's gone.
Well, I think that theme of change is not only apparent in the cycle of plays that has just been published, but also it's apparent in several of your movies, such as A Trip to Bountiful. And I'm wondering what kind of changes you've had to deal with in your life that has made the idea of coping with change such a potent one in your writing.
Well, I think anybody has to deal with change because life is constantly changing, and the perceptions that you have that you try to hold on to when you're young, so many things. I mean, people move away, and houses are sold, and people die, and new life comes into focus, and there are cycles of drought and cycles of too much rain. There is the unexpected is always there, and I think you really have to kind of find yourself not thrown by this and take life as it is, each moment as best you can.
A Trip to Bountiful is about trying to return to the past and realizing that the past is always out of reach and that you can't really get back there. And you write in the introduction to your new plays that your first memory was of stories about the past.
Yes.
But that it didn't take you long for you to learn that the past was gone and nothing could be done about it. And I wonder if there was a turning point in your realization of that, just as there was for the character in A Trip to Bountiful?
Well, I learned that lesson very early because I was raised on stories of I'm a Southerner, and my family have been in the area that I was born in for many, many years. And as I was growing up, I was told of all the things that the family had had and were lost and never to be gotten back. And so I soon learned that you had to give that up. I mean, so many of my family spent their lives in regretting that and being defeated by it. But I soon learned that that's death.
Do you ever feel that some of your plays are misunderstood and that people think that your plays are about returning to the past instead of learning to give it up?
They think they're nostalgic, and they're not at all. I have a certain desire to be fair to the past and as exact as I can be about the past, even a past that I've only heard about orally and haven't really lived through, because so many of my plays are based on stories that were passed down to me by other people. And I certainly think there are certain values in the past that we would be foolish to ignore and not to cherish and not to try to learn from. But I have no desire. I was thinking this morning, every day you read, what a terrible age we live in. Well, I've heard that all my life.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think any age is really any worse. They're just new problems, it's all, and different problems.
You know, I have to ask you one thing about Geraldine Page's performance in the film A Trip to Bountiful. She won an Academy Award for her performance in that. She acts very girlish, although she's an old woman in it. But she has these girlish, almost flirtatious mannerisms.
Like a coquette.
In it. Yeah, and I was wondering if you scripted that in, if that was part of your stage directions.
No. I don't do that for actors or actresses. Actually, you know, the part was originally created by Lillian Gish almost 30 years ago now. And you can't imagine two more different talents than Lillian Gish or Geraldine Page. And both in their own way were extraordinary in the part. And I learned a great lesson from that. It's like if you have two great virtuosos, two violinists, you know, playing your music, you just are grateful for the differences. You don't try to make them the same. And I never do that for an actress.
Playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote is my guest, and he's won two Academy Awards for his screenplays, for Tender Mercies and also for To Kill a Mockingbird, plus he wrote A Trip to Bountiful. Now, describe the place in Texas where you grew up, the place that was home to you when you were young.
Well, it's still home. I still have a house there, and I've been there for since Christmas. I just came back here about 2 weeks ago.
Here being New York.
New York, yes. Well, when I grew up, it was about 3,500, and I suppose over half of those were blacks. Mm-hmm. And now it's maybe a town of about 10,000 and a little bit more suburban. The town itself, what we knew as the town, it's like all least southern towns that I know, is disappearing, and there are shopping malls creeping out into the country. And, you know, houses are torn down, and
it's great. This is the exact opposite of what happens to the character in A Trip to Bountiful. She goes home and finds out that home doesn't exist anymore. It's become a ghost town.
That's right.
You go home, and there's shopping malls.
That's right. It's in that transformation that's going on all over America.
Now, a lot of people, once they become teenagers, are very restless and want to get away from home, especially if they've been brought up in a small town. But I think even a lot of people in big cities, they just want to make a break and start a new life for themselves as an adult. Did you go through a period of restlessness where, as absorbed as you are with your hometown now, did you want to go through a period of wanting to get away?
Not so much getting away from my hometown, but simply for a pragmatic reason. I wanted to be an actor.
Oh.
And I knew I couldn't be.
This is before you started writing.
That's right. I knew there was no future in that in Wharton, except, you know, the little theater, and that I had exhausted that. So, you know, there was no place to go for me unless, you know, I wanted to do something and had no idea I wanted to write. And perhaps just as well, because I think that my writing is helped by distance. In other words, I don't write too much about my town or my people. When I'm there, I'm too busy looking and watching and listening. And really, I do most of my writing. I keep journals and I work on other things, you know. But I do most of my writing of my plays when there's some distance between us.
Now, you bought the house that you grew up in, right?
That's right.
Who lives in it now?
I do.
I see. So when you go home, you're literally going home.
That's right. Yes, I'm going home. That's right. I not only bought that house, but I just bought the house next door. Because the house I grew up in, it has very large rooms, but like a lot of Southern houses, it only had two bedrooms. And I have four children, so if I wanted to entice my children down there, I had to get more space.
I understand. Let's talk about Tender Mercies, the screenplay that you won an Academy Award for a few years ago. Now, Robert Duvall starred as a country and western songwriter and singer whose career derails because of alcoholism. And as he's trying to get sober, he falls in love with a young, very humble widow and moves in with her and her son. Why don't we hear a clip from that movie?
I don't know if I was what you call rich, but I had a few dollars.
How'd you get it?
Writing songs.
And how'd you get my flat?
Well, people are crazy enough to pay you for it. They do it.
What happened to your money?
I lost it.
How?
Too much Applejack.
You think you'll ever be rich again?
Well, I'll tell you what, Sonny, I don't lay awake nights worrying about it. Now look, there's a D, right? D is in dog. Now watch me. I'll call him out. I've decided to leave G here forever. Not really. Let me know if you're staying behind. It's A7.
What did you relate to about that character that you created for Tender Mercies?
I'd known, actually, I model all my characters, really, in I take aspects of different people and kind of create a whole new person. And I really took as my model people I'd known in the theater. I didn't really know a lot about country western singing or singers. But I had known many people in the theater who were stars or near stars who had been defeated in some measure by alcoholism, and once in a while they'd defeated that and found a way to continue. So that really was kind of in my mind all the time I was creating Max Sledge.
Now, you had a hiatus in your career. It was hardly for the reasons Max Sledge did, the Robert Duvall character. But you kind of retired from playwriting for a while, vision.
Well, that's right. That's kind of a misapprehension. I really didn't retire from playwriting. I simply kind of went off into a quieter part of the world. I had a house in New Hampshire, and with my family, we lived out in the woods almost. But actually, I was doing a great deal of writing. I was writing all the 9 plays that the first volume has just been that you talked about was published. While I was there, and I wrote a couple of other plays, and then, you know, I began thinking about Tender Mercies while I was there. So it really was a very active time for me. I just kind of kept quiet and kept them all to myself.
Did you want to keep quiet, or had things dried up for you?
Well, nothing. I think that perhaps what had happened was that I was an interested observer in the behavior of the 60s and part of the 70s, and certainly didn't censor it, and again was interested in all that was going on, but I really didn't feel a great part of it. And felt that that was not a kind of an aesthetic an adjustment that I wanted to make. And I didn't feel that what I was working on at that time would be of particular interest to the things that were the people that were interested in the other things. So I just, you know, thought, well, I write really to do the best work I can, and if people like it or want it, that's fine. If they don't, I can't help it.
Do you feel that Tender Mercies got you, helped you to reach a new level of recognition?
Well, it certainly was, you know, it certainly did. There's always been a kind of a small base here in New York that if been, you know, kind to me and have been supportive. And I was doing, when I first came back before Tender Mercies, I went down to the HB Playwright Studio, which is on Bank Street, which Herbert Berghoff runs. And I did some plays there and kind of got my feet wet again. And then Tender Mercy certainly became, you know, I mean, more national recognition, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. We want to talk more, but first we're going to have to take a short break. My guest is playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote. He's speaking to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He won Academy Awards for his screenplays for To Kill a Mockingbird and Tender Mercies. He also wrote A Trip to Bountiful. Grove Press has just published four more plays from Foote's nine-play series, The Orphan's Home Cycle. Three of the plays were produced for PBS's American Playhouse last year, and there are plans to eventually produce all nine of those plays. We'll be back in just a few seconds. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Horton Foote is my guest. You know, we were just talking about Tender Mercies. Now, that starred Robert Duvall, who you had first worked with on To Kill a Mockingbird, which you also wrote won an Academy Award for. Now, the way I understand it, you actually suggested that Duvall be in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, what literally happened was that he was in a play of mine at the Neighborhood Playhouse. He was studying there.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandra Meisner, who was his teacher, asked me to come down and to watch a performance of the play. And I brought Robert Mulligan, who later was to direct Mockingbird, and myself and my wife and Kim Stanley. And we went down to see this play and this extraordinary performance by this young man. So when we were casting Mockingbird, really it was my wife that suggested to me that Duvall do it, and I called up Mulligan, and he'd already seen him, so he was very much in agreement.
So you've kept in touch with Duvall over the years?
Oh, yeah, we're very close. I talked to him yesterday, as a matter of fact.
You're working on a new project together?
Yes, we are. We start shooting one of the four plays in the Grove edition,
mm-hmm.
Convicts. We start that in December.
Will that be for a screen or for PBS?
For the screen.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, you know, you won an Academy Award for To Kill a Mockingbird. I want to play just a very short scene from it. The film starred Gregory Peck, and here he is.
How old were you when you got your first gun, Atticus?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later, he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much. And that I could shoot all of the blue jays I wanted, if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Don't need people's gardens. Don't nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
Now, the screenplay you wrote was an adaptation from a novel?
Mm-hmm, by Harper Lee.
Well, how did you feel about doing an adaptation and winning an Academy Award for it? Did you like doing... You did a lot of adaptations. You adapted Faulkner for Playhouse 90.
I did a lot. Not a lot. I've done... Well, let me see. I did Faulkner. I did Harper Lee. I did Flannery O'Connor,
mm-hmm.
which is not bad. I mean, if you're going to adapt, that's the kind of things you should adapt.
Was it fulfilling work to do adaptations?
Well, it's difficult work. It's not work that I relish because it's painful. Because you know, it's first of all, there's an enormous responsibility to a fellow artist, and secondly, it's painful to try to get into somebody else's psyche, you know, and to put on somebody else's skin, as it were, and to try to understand emotionally what the work is about.
Now, some of the adaptations you did were for Playhouse 90, the television series, television...
I did two
presentations back in the
1950s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now you're doing things that are being broadcast on public television's American Playhouse. Do you think the ground rules have changed in any way?
Well, actually, American Playhouse is a very progressive, wonderful. I think it's unusual. Actually, the things that I did for the American Playhouse were first released theatrically in 1918 and on Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm.
Courtship will be released theatrically, but that was the one that had not been seen before. But they made both of those possible. They financed them on Valentine's Day and Courtship, and without their help, I don't think we've ever made the films. And I think they more and more are helping out innovative and what I think is essentially very creative filmmaking.
Some of the plays in your 9-part cycle are set during the period of Reconstruction in the South, and in your introduction,
well, really late Reconstruction.
Okay, in the introduction to the new series of plays, you say that once when you were at home in Texas,
yeah,
you ran into a very old man, a black man,
mm-hmm,
who told you that he had worked on your great-great-grandfather's
mm-hmm
plantation.
Mm-hmm.
What did that make you think about? How did you feel
I say in the introduction, I mean, it gave me a whole new perspective of what that meant. I mean, you know, I just had only had a vague kind of sense of what it meant to be a slave, and I certainly saw this human being, and I suddenly realized what a monstrous thing it must have been, and it wasn't a happy thought. I mean, it wasn't a happy experience to think that part of my family had been involved in that, but it was a reality, and was something that I was grateful that I was able so young to understand the terrors of it.
You know, in a lot of ways, I think an experience like that would make some people want to leave home, so that you wouldn't be seen as the great-great-grandson of a slave owner.
Well, I mean, where are you going to go? I mean, wherever you go, that's what you are, and that's what you came from. And, you know, I mean, there were also many positive things around me, and people had made different adjustments to a really tragic time, because Reconstruction was difficult for everybody, and their lives were picked up, and they didn't dwell on that. And certainly my own father was a living example of he was enormously close to black people. As a matter of fact, in one of the plays, it's about an experience of his when he lived with a black family as a boy of 12 or 13, and he was the only white person on the plantation. And he was so felt so loved and wanted that he wouldn't even go home for Christmas. So all that has a double side, you know. You just can't say, take one thing and say, well, that's ruined everything, because there are many compensating things that in the mix, so to speak.
Another of your plays, called 1918,
mm-hmm,
is about death by flu. It's during the flu epidemic,
yep,
in 1918, and death by war, World War I.
Yeah.
Did you hear a lot of stories about both when you were growing up?
Well, yes, but more about the flu than about the war, really.
Well, families lost a lot of people during
the
flu.
Well, actually, the flu epidemic killed more people than the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, knew no boundaries. I mean, the people that the war couldn't get, I mean, women and children and kings and queens, the flu got. And it was a devastation. And I, in working on it, I thought it was interesting that actually I did the play first of all down at the HB, and when Herbert saw it, he said, you know what this play is about? And I often don't know what my plays are about, so I was happy to hear. And he said, this play is about expected death and unexpected death. And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, of course it is, because the expected death was what will happen if you go to France or to the war, and the unexpected death was the flu, which just quietly came into a house, and nobody was expecting it, and took people, killed them.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about death reminds me of a line that's very moving from A Trip to Bountiful. It's one of Geraldine Page's lines. And in explaining why she wants to go back to the home she grew up in and that she raised her children in, she says that two of her babies are buried there.
Mm.
And it made me really think about the pull that the dead exert on you,
mm,
from the place where, you know, where your loved ones are buried.
Yeah.
Is that something you've thought about a lot?
Well, as a matter of fact, what has always haunted me is that when I was growing up, and we often, because my grandfather's death, my grandmother often went out to the cemetery, and she'd take me with her. And there in the family plot were two graves of children of hers that had died as infants. And I constantly thought about them, and it was never mentioned, never talked about. I never even saw a picture of them. But there they were, and certainly the memory of them must have lived on in all these people, you know. And it's something that is, it does have its own reality for you.
You are still living part of the time in New York now?
Yes.
Do you feel alienated in cities? You seem so drawn to
I love New York. I don't get to spend much time here. Actually, I'm only here now for 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'm on my way again.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing a play at the Pittsburgh Public Playhouse this fall. And I go to Richmond tomorrow on Sunday to lecture, and so I wander around a lot. But, oh, no, I think this is a great, great city, and if I couldn't live in any other city in the world, really.
Okay. Before we run out of time, just tell us briefly about Convicts, the play that you're making into a movie with Robert Duvall.
Well, it's part of the 9 play cycle, and it's the second in the cycle, and it's a story, basically, of a young white boy, who's living on a plantation, running a country store there for his uncle, who's gone back to town. And it's a plantation worked by black convicts. And the plantation is owned by an old man of 78, who Robert Duvall will play, who is dying. And it's the relationship between this young boy and this dying old man is what the story basically is about.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. My guest has been playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote, and he wrote the screenplays for Tender Mercies, he wrote A Trip to Bountiful, and won an Academy Award for his screenplay for To Kill a Mockingbird. His Grove Press has published 4 more plays from his 9-play series, The Orphan's Home Cycle, and he's working on staging the entire cycle of plays for Public Television's American Playhouse. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, our guest will be jazz bassist Milt Hinton. He got his start in Cab Calloway's band and went on to become one of the most in-demand bassists in jazz. Along the way, he's taken thousands of photographs of jazz musicians that have been exhibited in galleries and are now collected in a new book. I hope you can join us. Here's music from Horton Foote's film Tender Mercies, performed by Robert Duvall.
Let me know, that's G, if you always will want me. Or if you wander into another's arms, A or A7, G. Let me know what you decide, dear, and let me rest, my head for a while.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Independent filmmaker Robert Muggy captured jazz musician Sonny Rollins leaping off the stage and breaking a foot in concert, soul star turned minister Al Green preaching in the pulpit, and Hawaiian musicians performing music that challenges any stereotypes you may have. Public television is showcasing Muggy's music movies this summer. Coming up, we meet Robert Muggy. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle performs a couple of songs by one of America's greatest songwriters, Cole Porter. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews a new photo exhibit at New York's Museum of Modern Art, highlighting the career of Gary Winogrand. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm in Washington. Rescuers in Brownsville, Texas, are still searching for survivors of yesterday's department store collapse. At least 11 people were killed and at least 50 were injured when the roof fell in yesterday. Two women and four children were pulled from the rubble this morning, including a 2-year-old girl who was apparently protected by the bodies of the people around her. Officials believe there is at least one person still alive in the wreckage. The 3-story Amigos store collapsed during a storm that dumped more than 2 inches of rain in less than 30 minutes. Lawyers for Attorney General Edwin Meese are refusing to comment on a National Public Radio report that independent counsel James McKay decided not to prosecute Meese, despite some evidence Meese could be charged with 2 felonies. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Knowledgeable sources say that prior to the filing of the McKay report this week, Meese's lawyers were told that McKay had decided not to prosecute Meese on 2 felony charges, even though Meese, in McKay's view, had violated the law. Both charges, said the sources, involved Meese's ownership of some $14,000 worth of Baby Bell phone company stock at a time when those phone companies were pressing Meese and the Justice Department to make a major policy change that would directly benefit the regional phone companies. The U.S. Criminal Code bars an official from knowingly participating in any matter in which he or his family have a financial interest. Meese's lawyers issued a statement today saying, quote, "It's been our policy not to discuss communications we've had with Mr. McKay and his staff." The statement continued, "Mr. McKay determined that he would not file and pursue criminal charges. The avenue by which he arrived at that result or the rationale he employed is entirely beside the point," close quote. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that the United States has sent messages of condolence to the countries of airline passengers killed in the U.S. attack on an Iranian airliner. President Reagan today himself said the issue of compensating Iran for the Airbus disaster is under consideration by his administration. But spokesman Fitzwater said there are still some open questions to be answered before a decision is made. Fitzwater said one of the driving forces behind our consideration is simply the moral responsibility of America in shooting down an Iranian passenger plane with 290 people aboard. Iraq said today its warplanes over the Persian Gulf attacked 2 supertankers full of Iranian oil. Iran's Armed Forces Command today ordered a general military mobilization. Also today, an Iranian leader spoke of a worldwide conspiracy against his country. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Tehran.
The downing of an Iranian civilian airliner by a U.S. warship is part of the conspiracy, said Hashemi Rafsanjani at Friday prayers today in Tehran. However, Rafsanjani said Iranians should avoid revenge against the United States. He suggested diplomatic revenge instead. Iran's case will be taken before the United Nations on Tuesday. Rafsanjani called on the UN to condemn the U.S. and order the U.S. fleet out of the Gulf. Today, Iran's Armed Forces Command called on everyone who could carry a gun to report for military duty. In a broadcast on Tehran Radio monitored today, the Army Command said there was a manpower shortage in the war with Iraq. In Tehran, this is Deborah Amos.
Navy experts are examining radio data today, trying to find out why a Trident II submarine missile failed its test last night. The $23.7 million weapon launched quickly went off course and had to be destroyed 60 seconds after launching. Debris fell into the ocean several miles southeast of Cape Canaveral. The test was the 13th in 20 planned launchings of the Trident. It was only the 2nd failure. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 16 points to finish the day and the week at 2106.15. Declines led advances 8-5 and volume of 137 million shares. The average price of a share in the exchange lost 18 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On today's performance spot, we bring back singer Susanna McCorkle for a couple of Cole Porter songs. Susanna says that whenever she sings Porter, audiences respond to the lyrics.
Some people came up to me after this song when I sang it in New Jersey and said, you know, that has an anti-New Jersey reference in it. I said, I'm terribly sorry, really. I try not to offend anyone. And I thought about it, and sure enough, it does. It's anti-New Jersey.
Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is it for all time or simply a lark? Is it the Lido I see or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it a long last love? Will it be tender and sweet or merely massage? Is it a brainstorm in one of its quirks? Or is it the best, the crest, the works? Is it rescue or is it to wreck? Is it an ache in the heart? Just a pain in the neck? Is it the ivy you touch with a glove? Or is it a long last love? Should I say thumbs down and give it a shove? Or is it a long
one's about maybe falling in love and wondering and worrying and asking yourself some questions so you won't get in trouble again. This one is about somebody who did get in trouble. A bittersweet song about a romance that went bad but was sure worth it while it lasted.
As Dorothy Parker once said to her boyfriend, fare thee well. As Columbus announced when he found he was bounced, it was swell, Isabel, swell. As Abelard said to Eloise, don't forget to drop a line to me, please. As Juliet cried in her Romeo's ear, Romeo, why not face the fact? My dear, it was just one of those things, just one of those crazy flings, one of those bells that now and then rings, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings. Just one of those things. If we'd thought of it to the end of it when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, and amen. Here's hoping we meet now and then. Well, it was great fun, but it was just one of those things.
Susanna McCorkle was joined by Ben Aronoff on piano and Chip Jackson on bass. She's about to make a new record for the Concord Jazz label. Fresh air. It's rare for public television to showcase the body of work of one independent filmmaker, but over the summer, six music documentaries made by Robert Muggy will be shown in a series called Summer Night Music. The films combine concert performances with interviews. The musicians featured are Reuben Blades, Al Green, Sonny Rollins, and Gil Scott-Heron. Also in the series are two compilation films, one on reggae music and one on Hawaiian music. This week, many stations will air the film Gospel According to Al Green. Al Green was a star soul singer during the early 70s, but he left soul music after a spiritual reawakening and for more than a decade has run a church in Memphis, Tennessee, where he preaches and produces gospel records.
Ooh, Jesus, you don't think you're having no trouble now because Jesus has been through this. Jesus has the way.
When you were making your movie on Al Green, he wasn't singing any of his soul music. He was only singing gospel music. Now, I think a lot of times when you're doing a documentary about someone, there's this tug of war about what the filmmaker really wants in the movie musically and what the performer really wants in it. Did that happen to you with Al Green? Did you want him to perform soul music even though he wasn't doing it anymore?
Yes, I did. And it took creating some very special situations to sort of not trick him into doing it, but convince him in a sly way, shall I say, to doing it. One was he knew that I had already filmed him in a concert situation and in the church situation doing gospel songs. I sat him down to do an interview in his own studio in Memphis. He gave him a guitar that belonged to one of his guitarists and said, you know, if you don't mind, when you're talking about the old days, illustrate some of the early period with some of those old songs. So he'd do a little bit of "I'm Tired of Being Alone" or something like that, and then later we grouped around him his musicians into what we said would be a sort of a rehearsal situation. He rehearsed, quote-unquote, a number of the gospel songs. Then we said, gee, it'd be fun to hear you do Let's Stay Together. And so we managed to get him to do that song. But it was very important for the themes of the film to show the progression from the earlier work to the later, whatever I had to do to get him performing it.
I'm going to ask you about another movie, and this is your movie about jazz tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins, who's considered by many like the most extraordinary jazz improviser performing today. Now, he's someone who, it's been my experience, isn't that interested in doing interviews. He's not a very public type of performer. Did you have to do a lot of convincing to get him to be the subject of one of your movies?
I had to do some convincing, but the main convincing was done by his wife, Lucille. Lucille had decided that, I think even before I contacted them, that Sonny was doing the best playing of his entire life and that this was a period which needed to be properly documented. Sonny didn't enter this kicking and screaming, but he entered it the way he enters most things, cautiously, with some reluctance, and then only once the cameras were rolling and all that did he give out this unbelievable performance that, you know, I thank God we were able to capture. But then that's part of what's so special about Sonny is very unpredictable. And that comes through in his art as well as in his life. And that's part of why I wanted to do a film on Sonny in particular, is I wanted to do a film about improvisation, both as a musical tool in American music and in particular Black American music, but also as a way of living your life.
Sonny Rollins in your movie did something very unpredictable that made for an incredibly dramatic moment on film. He was playing, and you were filming him playing, in a rock quarry in upstate New York, and he was playing on a rock stage about 6 feet above the ground.
Right.
He's playing this long improvisation that would lead into the piece that he'd finally end up playing. And in the middle of this improvisation, he decides to jump off the stage. A 6 foot leap.
Yeah.
I'd like to just play for our listeners what that sounded like, and you'll hear the break in the playing. Through your mind when you saw him jump off that stage?
Well, horror, because he has just jumped off the stage and fallen flat on his back on solid rock. That's what Sonny did. We did not stop filming, but I ran down to see, is he okay? Before I got there, as he was lying there flat on his back, audience standing up, you know, with a loud gasp and everything, all of a sudden he starts playing again, lying there on his back, which is something the cameras did capture. We later found out he had broken his heel. But, yeah, it becomes a pivotal moment in the film because here we have improvisation in life and improvisation in art to the nth degree.
Let's get to your new movie. Your latest movie is called Hawaiian Rainbow, and it's about the different forms of Hawaiian music being performed now right. in Hawaii, with a look back at the history of where these forms come from, the many influences that have, you know,
right.
been heard in Hawaiian music. I think for a lot of us, we think Hawaiian music, and we see and hear a lot of cliches from all the Andy Williams specials in Hawaii, Perry Como. Yeah, right.
Ho,
yeah. Do you have all these cliches in mind?
I had them all in mind before I went to Hawaii, and it's funny because I went there 2 years ago on the way, just spending 2 days on the way to Australia. I intended really to look into Aboriginal music in Australia, which I did somewhat. But the funny thing was, in those 2 days in Hawaii, I overheard sounds that were unlike anything I'd heard before. And I just said to myself, something is going on here. My goodness, there is a real movie here, at least one. In fact, I'm about to do a second movie down there on Hawaiian dance. But what I decided to do was to make a film which would show Hawaiian music from the great ancient traditions right up through all the different sort of modern subgenres that are going on there now.
There's one group who you filmed called the San Bernard Trio. And San Bernard, the lead singer in it, has this really beautiful, very unusual falsetto. Who is he? How did you find him?
Some people who study Hawaiian music down in Hawaii took me to see him because they saw him as an example of one of the finest contemporary Hawaiian styles. And, you know, I came in and here's this guy, several hundred pounds, but singing, as you say, with this beautiful, ethereal-sounding falsetto.
Yeah.
And he's got it with, he's playing this tiny little ukulele, and on one side of him is a guitar player, on the other side is a bass player, and out of the audience is coming one after another of hula dancers dancing to these traditional songs that he's doing with so much gusto. I don't know how else to say it.
Ooh, he opens where the moon shines on the sand. And the beach boys surfing in with the tide to the shore, with girls side by side. All the sand, you'll hear music of old and new. And the beach boys are now playing and singing out there, Lili.
One of the things which runs through all these films that are in this series, as well as the other films I've done on Sun Ra and composer George Crumb and others, is that I'm most interested in music which hasn't been cut off from its natural roots. Music which says something about the culture from which it comes or the subculture from which it comes, which says something about the lives of the people who are creating it. You know, all too often today, music is just a corporate product. And it's totally cut off from anything outside of musical notes.
Well, congratulations on the film festival.
Thanks.
Six of Robert Muggy's films can be seen on many public television stations this summer in a series called Summer Night Music.
Under the palm trees where music
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's happening on All Things Considered, which is coming up. Robert Siegel is joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
I hear you're following up the Ed Meese resignation story.
That's right. Nina Totenberg has been covering the precise terms of the resignation and the conclusions reached by the special prosecutor, McKay. She'll have more on this evening on the program.
What else are you doing?
Well, we have an eyewitness account of the collapse of the Amigo department store in Brownsville, Texas. It must have been quite a scene at the moment. People were huddled against the front of the store to stay out of the rain. And so there was an unusual crowd right in front of it. Also, we talked with a British reporter about the biggest Anglo-Saudi arms deal ever. In fact, the biggest British arms deal ever. In fact, the biggest British sale of anything to another country ever.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A retrospective of the work of the late photographer Gary Winogrand is now on view at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and the show's catalog is available at many bookstores. Critic at large Laurie Stone says Winogrand's images are both singular and universal.
You may have seen Gary Winogrand's pictures. They're full of speed and energy, crammed with detail, showing situations and people slightly off kilter. Winogrand came up in the 50s. He was one of the new breed of photojournalists who fancied themselves adventurers and who admired the grainy, anti-aesthetic look of Italian movies. He died of cancer in 1984, and this thrilling retrospective, offering a sweep of the artist's life, testifies to his enduring imprint on photography and on our imaginations. Winogrand's vision is amazingly consistent. His photographs are autobiography, illustrating his absorptions. They're like a marathon cartoon strip. He once said he photographed in order to see what the things that interested him looked like as photographs. He loves watching women move. They don't have to be beautiful in a conventional way. His focus confers power and sensuality. In one shot, a young woman is caught in heedless rapture. She holds a melting ice cream cone and throws back her head laughing. Her pleasure makes her indifferent to the fact that the ice cream may drip on her coat. Winogrand loves watching people watching others. In many photographs, several groups with varying motives are caught in a single frame. You ask, as Winogrand did, playing detective, shrink, and novelist, what's the story? Winogrand grew up in a crowded Bronx tenement, and for privacy and space, he took to the streets early. Throughout his career, the streets, especially New York streets, are his true home, and public spaces his true setting. In anonymity, he finds the feeling of belonging that others seek in family life. Among strangers, out in the world, he feels free, and he's forever watching for the intimate moment, people exposing their feelings, their sense of surprise, their ambivalence. A coiffed woman dancing at El Morocco reveals her boredom over her partner's shoulder. A man in a suit does a backflip on the street for no apparent reason. Often, Winogrand identifies with trapped or imperiled animals, and some of his pictures are harrowing, images you wish you weren't seeing but can't evade. From a car window, he catches a dog on a highway, destined, an instant after the camera shutter has snapped, to die under the wheels of an oncoming car. Winogrand often prowled zoos, making common cause and extraordinary eye contact with large, sad-looking beasts. An orangutan lies on its side, with piercing intelligence on its almost human face. A huge walrus peers knowingly at Winogrand's lens, while a trio of human onlookers is closed off from their intimate moment. Frequently, too, Winogrand is impelled by the moment when impetuous love sneaks up among humans and between humans and animals. A whale in an underwater tank shares a stare of love and longing with a man cleaning his window. At a Texas fair, a heifer shoots a kiss at a cowboy, tipping the man's hat with its huge tongue. Winogrand's world is full of drive, self-involvement, and startling spectacle amid seeming ordinariness. In his work, we see the man's voyeurism and longing, and we see ourselves as we exist in the world, trying to mask ourselves and put on a social face, but inevitably exposing ourselves, becoming vulnerable, and in doing that, appearing not repellent as we fear, but becoming fit subjects for a spirit like Winogrand's.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. The Gary Winogrand exhibit will be at the Museum of Modern Art through August 16th. Then it travels to Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other cities. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we'll hear from Louis Rukeyser, the pun-loving host of Wall Street Week, the weekly appraisal of the world of investments that is consistently one of the top-rated programs on public television. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a reissue of a 1965 session led by the late pianist Earl Hines. And television critic David Bianculli will preview Alive from Off-Center and American Masters, two public television series that begin new seasons later in the week. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Martin Foys, Deirdre Benzing, and Dan Cornwell. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.